Taking Action for Racial Justice. Racial justice protests are no longer making headlines. Today, we aren't seeing the streets of cities and towns across America filled with marchers holding signs and chanting. But the movement has not faded away. Rather, this is the period many activists believe is the most important, when the rubber hits the road for creating real change. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, what is being done around Maine to create new policy and affect change? In the months since the Black Lives Matter protests, how are governments, schools, police departments, and community groups evaluating themselves and what they can do differently? We'll hear from policymakers, officials, and activists from around the state. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The death of George Floyd and the protests that followed ignited national attention to the problem of systemic racism, including here in Maine. Today, we'll discuss what's being done now to promote greater racial justice. We have a number of people calling in during this hour, but joining us for the entire hour, Dustin Ward, who is a racial equity and reconciliation advocate who founded an organization called It Is Time. He is also a former pastor. Hi, Dustin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me.
We invite your comments and questions in the audience. What do you see happening in your community or not happening? What would you like to see? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Why don't I start, Dustin, by asking you about your organization, It Is Time. What are the goals and how are you planning to achieve them?
So right now, our goal, in simple ways, is it is time to end racism. We want to root out racism in really all communities and all places of Maine and hopefully in New England. And so what our focus really is on advocacy for black and brown individuals here in all communities in the state of Maine, but also we want to work with our white brothers and sisters on reconciliation, and that's why I'm a racial equity and reconciliation. We want to bring equitable practices, equitable access, but also reconciliation. So for me, what we focus on is, one, the education. We want to bring historical education and explain to individuals, how did we get here, and how does that help kind of forward think our future? How do we make changes from that? Our big goals, especially for us as an organization, we want to see economic empowerment. We want to impact the economy of black and brown individuals. That's been a huge issue, is just the wealth gap for black and brown individuals. And we want to see policies and decision-making happen. So we get on a very community level, and we try to both bring the education. Hopefully that changes how we bring different decisions in the process.
I was looking at your website, and I see you've built all of this around three very basic principles: learn, think, act. Tell me how that works in practice.
Absolutely. So in order to figure out, you know, where you're going, you got to figure out where you've been. You have to learn, and that starts with hearing and listening. You want to know the origins, the history of black and brown individuals. I don't think a lot of individuals have really understood not just civil rights, but slavery. You know, how did we even get racism to begin with in this country and in this world? So we start with learning. What that should feed into is thinking. That's the empathizing. That's personalizing what you're learning about, being able to bring it kind of home to bear for the individual. And so once you have those two, you learn, you think, that should change action. And I always encourage people to speak up, speak out. That's something that we've all got to be able to do, especially when it comes to racism, speaking out against it, speaking against it in our places. But you can only do that if you learn and think, know where you're coming from, and have empathized with it. And so for us, it's simple, but it's actually a lot of work. And that's a good thing, because this is not something that happens overnight.
All right. I want to ask you what you're seeing around the state. What kind of initiatives are you seeing in local governments that you think are promising? What kind of things are you seeing happening that you think are missing the mark?
So right now, what's actually very promising is there is an awakening, if you will. What happened with the events of George Floyd and us watching that murder play out has really created a spark. And initially, we got really conversation out of it. People began talking. But at some point, and we're hitting that, talk kind of has subsided, and now we want action, we want change. So we're watching as municipalities and governments are wanting to rethink their own conversation. So they're changing a lot of what they have written on the books. They want different ordinances, and they want to come out against racism. But then they want to change that and say, okay, how can our practices going forward be equitable? I'm seeing a lot of organizations and businesses want to take action and say, you know what, we want to fix what's going on in our own local business, right? How do we interact with the clients that we serve? And I'm seeing more education, more people wanting to get into reading. So those are great things. Those are hitting the mark, and we are encouraged by them, especially as the Black community. I think what's missing the mark, or what maybe could be some good potential, is kind of the key that I myself am really pushing for, is the economic empowerment, right? We haven't really gotten to the point where we've seen, you know, solid change in terms of how do we improve the economic lives of our Black and brown brothers and sisters who have really been disadvantaged. And we've seen that with COVID now. We've seen that with statistical data that systemic racism has provided. So that's kind of, we're on the precipice of big change there, but that's been what's really been missing the mark.
All right. Well, we are joined now by David Patrick with Racial Equity and Justice. David, hi. Thanks so much for calling in. Tell us about the work that your organization has been doing.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me.
David, your voice is very faint. Are you? Can you come closer to the receiver?
Hi, can you hear me better now?
That's a little bit better. Yeah, go ahead.
How about now? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's great. Go ahead and tell us about your organization.
So our organization is Racial Equity and Justice. We are, you know, primarily located in the Penobscot area, but we have a collective similar to the previous organization mentioned of Black, brown, and Indigenous people of color. We do a lot of similar work, right? A lot of the education work, a lot of policy reform, working in spaces where elected officials, working with our representatives in the classroom, in businesses and things like that. And I think we've also been really pleased with some of the progress that we've seen, right? Some of the sentiment and some of the attitude, but not just necessarily that, also the actions that are following those. So in our own community, we have an advisory board that's been established. In local school systems, we see them reviewing curriculum and through those audits, introducing a selection of more diverse authors and artists and things like that. And then on a community level, more grants and more projects. But I want to just kind of back up because one of the really important things that we do has been the work that we do within our own community. And so as our organization kind of exists as a dichotomy where we're working with, as the previous speakers said, our white allies and other community members, but then also providing a healing space for Black, brown, Indigenous people of color, providing opportunities for community, obviously outside of COVID, a space for gathering and processing, and just that space to recharge as we go in and out of the work that we do.
Sure. David, let me ask you this. How are you and people who work with you received in your community? Do you feel as though there's resistance, or do you feel as though people are eager to learn and change?
Right. So I think I'll try to answer that question as best as I can. So, right, it's a dualistic kind of approach. We're received well by a lot of people. But I think one of the key components that we really focus in on when we're doing this work is the fact that this work isn't intended for the individual who's intentionally holding on to white supremacist ideology or to bigoted and outdated philosophy. The work we do is really based on the assumption that the reason some of these things are happening in the community, in the workplace, in, you know, on college campuses, wherever, is because people haven't been given the tools they need to successfully navigate conversations of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we see that from the perspective of our own communities expending energy in places where maybe somebody isn't receptive to change, or all of the attention being focused on that percentage of people, no matter what you say, they're not going to change. And that is a missed opportunity to focus on younger generations, you know, those who we wouldn't normally have the opportunity to work with, but so much of the energy with racial equity, justice, and inclusion work being focused on those who aren't.
Oh, shoot. I think we just lost David. It's my fault. I'm sorry about that, David. And thank you so much for calling in, David Patrick with Racial Equity and Justice. We're going to turn now to Chief Sean Lally of the Westbrook Police Department. Chief, thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about the Westbrook Police Department's effort to address racial inequities. Can you describe what you're doing?
Sure. We've been at this for quite a bit. Chief Janine Roberts was really instrumental in bringing some of these implicit bias trainings and different diversity trainings to our department. So started off really last spring. We had scheduled implicit bias training for the entire department, but then COVID happened. And then, obviously, the events of May 25th, 2000 kind of put a real spotlight on law enforcement and some of the inequities that have been going on in this country. So, obviously, we had to redouble our efforts there. So, in October, we had implicit bias training for the entire department. And actually, it was a regional training that our district training council brought to the area. We had Dr. Bryant Marks from Morehouse College. He's the chief equity officer, and he's a social psychologist who gave us a day-long training on implicit bias. And it was a good eye-opener for a lot of the officers, I believe, just to see another perspective and to realize that we all have biases.
I wanted to ask you about what kind of reaction did you see among your officers doing this kind of work? It does require some level of self-analysis.
It does. And, you know, it's an eye opener because, you know, for example, we're always told this country is a nation of immigrants and I'm a son of immigrants. And, you know, I believe that. And then, but from Dr. Mark's perspective, he said, well, consider this. If you were brought here in chains, are you an immigrant? And, you know, things like that bring on self-reflection. And I think it's that awareness that helps us get better at what we do.
All right. Do you feel as though the criticism of police as a whole is warranted regarding racial profiling and systemic racism?
I don't think that you can characterize any person, generalize people. So if someone makes a bad pizza, every pizza maker's, you know, is terrible. That's ridiculous. Is there racial bias? Is there implicit bias? Is there unfair treatment across this country? Yes, absolutely. But to paint everybody with the same broad brush is it's unfair. And there are a lot of police officers, law enforcement professionals who do a really good job in this country. And I'm proud of the officers here at Westbrook PD because I know they do this job every day and they care about the people they serve.
Chief Lally, before I let you go, we already have an email in that I think you're the right person to answer. This is an email from Bruce. He asks, are chokeholds legal by law or police union contracts in Maine? It troubles me to think I could have sanctioned this through my political representatives.
No, they're not taught. The Maine Criminal Justice Academy's Board of Trustees is basically the they have a number of model policies that we're all under law expected to adopt, and chokeholds have not been sanctioned in the state of Maine as long as I've been a police officer, and that's 24 years now. So they're not legal, and we don't teach them, and they would be considered a use of deadly force, and they're not again, we don't do that here.
Well, yeah, Chief Lally, thanks so much for calling in. And before we let you go, I was wondering if you have anything else that you think is important for people to know about your department and its efforts toward, raising awareness and looking inward.
Sure. One more thing that we've done, we've partnered with Georgetown Law and the ABLE program, which is Active Bystander for Law Enforcement Training, which basically it's designed to prepare officers to successfully intervene in situations to prevent harm to people. It also is aimed at creating a culture that supports peer intervention. So we're one of the first in Maine to do that, and South Portland PD is another one. So hopefully this training will take root in Maine and help us all be better at what we do.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Sean Lally, who is chief of the Westbrook Police Department. I'm going to try to squeeze in a question before our break. I'm going to go to Brett in Hancock. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Jennifer. Question for your panel, some advice, I guess, I'm looking for us over here in Hancock County. And I'll just give a real quick background. So we don't have the leadership that it sounds like Westbrook has in our sheriff's department. So when this summer there were peaceful Black Lives Matter protests in our region, our sheriff decided to try to purchase riot gear against the wishes of our community, and then also forbid services to residents of our county jail for addiction coaching because an organization had supported Black Lives Matter to which he called a terrorist group. So we've been dealing with this sort of lack of thoughtful leadership in our communities, policing at the county level. And I'm curious if there's examples in the state for ways to provide some tools to help us work with our county law enforcement to either have some accountability over leadership, bring resources that can help our county law enforcement, just sort of make Hancock County a little or just even slightly more progressive in how we approach this kind of stuff at the sheriff's
level. Dustin, what are your thoughts and what advice do you have for Brett?
Yeah, there's two I have for him. One that I've seen and currently think could work is as community members, if you have community members that are actively wanting to see change, maybe you make an initial response to that sheriff and begin to try to encourage that individual to have a place where he can begin to express his sentiments. Right now we have an issue of trust in this country, and so I think rebuilding that trust would be important. So I've seen community members gather together and get their foot in the door in the sheriff's office and say, let's have constant conversations about what is going on, because I think right now there's just a miscommunication and a mistrust. The other way I've seen it is work with your local officials, maybe town managers, maybe individuals who are policymakers, to then say, hey, can you bring in somebody or work with someone to find a safe space that law enforcement can have conversations about what they're going through. Right now, I think the biggest thing is trying to get both individuals, the Black community and our law enforcement, on the same page, hearing one another, and beginning to rebuild that trust so that what you're talking about, which I've heard has happened in the news, is no more, and that we can move together in a peaceful manner. So I hope maybe that's some just off the cuff initial things, but I've seen both of those actually begin to work or are options towards that.
All right, Brett, thanks so much for your call. If you would like to join this conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Community Foundation, saluting frontline workers, nonprofit organizations, and donors for their strength and support.
For COVID-19 patients, in addition to illness, there are other traumatic side effects. A music therapist in Virginia started a weekly support group for COVID patients to help them deal with social isolation and loneliness.
We know that music is this, this portal, this instrument that the brain connects with.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Is your business or organization ready to take on 2021? Maine Public can help you connect with Maine's largest radio audience to put you on the right trajectory. We've created a series of new underwriting opportunities called Launchpad Packages that are specially designed to share your strategic messaging in an effective and budget-conscious way. For information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Support or contact our underwriting team at underwriting@mainepublic.org and see what we can do to help you. Again, that's underwriting@mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, efforts in Maine to end systemic racism in government, education, and in our communities. Joining me, Dustin Ward, racial equity and reconciliation advocate and founder of the organization It Is Time, and others who are calling in throughout the program working with racial justice organizations. If you would like to share your comments or questions, email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Noelle Chaddick, Vice President for Equity and Inclusion at Bates College. Thanks for calling in, Dr. Chaddick.
Thank you so much for having me again. How are you today?
I'm great, and thank you back for calling back to Maine Calling. I know that you're helping to lead a concerted anti-racism effort at Bates, and this is on many fronts. Tell us how it came about.
Well, it came about long before I got here. Folks at Bates have been working on this for a very long time, and the leadership at Bates decided that they needed to elevate the position so that this person was sitting at the table in senior administration working closely with the other vice presidents and with the president. And then through that process over the last 20 months, it has just been looking at where we are, where we need to be, having lots of constituent conversations, and really listening closely to our students, faculty, staff, and alumni.
People may not know that Bates has a long history of, it was founded by abolitionists, and that it has a long history in trying to do racial justice work, whatever that meant at the time, but has really, as you've examined the history of the college, found it to be more aspirational than reality, correct?
Well, so I think what's amazing about the work that Bates has been doing is that before I ever got here, they had already started to think about their origin story as aspirational. And so our founders were Free Will Baptists who were involved in the abolitionist movement, but they also did a lot of the same things that college founders did during the time of our founding. And so we've had students on campus work with faculty to go ahead and really antagonize that origin story. Yes, it's aspirational, but I also find a lot of evidence that over the years, folks have tried to meet that aspiration. I think it's really important in the truth, racial healing, and transformation work that we're doing that we grapple with that truth and we articulate that truth. And I've waited a long time to work in an organization where the president comes out and says, we have not hit this mark yet. This is aspirational. And President Spencer has invited all of us to come to the table for this heavy lift.
Does this mean that there are changes in the curriculum at Bates?
So we actually are in the process, under the leadership of Dr. Malcolm Hill, who's our Vice President of Academic Affairs. He's just sent out the call for nominations for a faculty working group who are going to be tasked with identifying pathways forward in response to our students, who gave us a big call for a curricular requirement back in the fall. And it is, the goal of the college to make sure that our students encounter curricular content that addresses race, racism, power, and privilege. And a deep data dive is underway to identify where that content is already being taught. And I'm looking forward to supporting academic affairs and our faculty and students in that work.
Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Noelle Chaddick, President for Equity and Inclusion at Bates College. Thanks so much for calling in. We are going to, Dustin, I wanted to ask you, a little bit about that and what you're seeing at other universities and colleges around the state. Are you seeing the same kind of work that Bates is doing?
Yeah, I would. You can tell that there's a step-by-step process. It isn't just jump the gun, but in universities, it's a bringing in a group or an equity team that begins to look at both practices and principles and the education. But then, even at the undergrad, the high school level, I'm seeing a lot of schools that want to realign their curriculum to begin teaching a more fuller context of history, and a lot of staff members who are saying, you know, we need a little bit of training as well, but also we need to look at relook at our curriculum. So I don't think it's just universities. I think it's starting to seep into other public education systems and other schools as well.
All right, we're going to go to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just remembering many, many years ago. I'm sorry about my wife's rooster. Many, many years ago, we authorized a casino in Bangor, and at the very same time, we didn't allow our native Aboriginals to have a casino of their own. It was depressing, and it made me ashamed to call myself a maniac.
Oh, and you know, Dustin, this is something a lot of people talk about, and I know that many tribal members feel that this is a double standard that reflects racism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, I appreciate Larry calling in and mentioning this. I think that this was just one example of how much tribal leaders and our BIPOC communities have that feeling that we're seeing one group, you know, being able to get these certain things, but when we are requesting of it, it's shot down or it's not for us. And so those slights and those slow microaggressions can build over time. And again, that's what can seep in and create such division. We got to start healing that piece. So, you know, I thank Larry for continuing to keep that on his forefront. Hopefully, as we move forward, those types of slights are not going to continue.
Calling in now, Abdul Ali. He's an activist and poet and works with Maine Youth Justice, as well as the Young People's Caucus, and he's a fellow at the University of Southern Maine. Ali, thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us about the work for racial justice that you're involved with and the role of young people in this.
Well, there's tons of work of racial justice. I think it's really specifying it to one factor would be very difficult. Right now, there's Maine Youth Justice, which is the campaign to close down the juvenile facility. We have about 28 youth left in there. There's $18.2 million that's going through there every year that we want to reinvest back into the communities. We're doing a lot of work around there, trying to work with youth, we actually have a board of youth steering committee members that are, some of them are previously incarcerated, some of them are not. And, they kind of lead the way on decisions that we need to make. And then there's the University of Southern Maine, which is the Opportunity Scholars, which is a program where anybody that's previously incarcerated, anybody that's ever been affected by any type of systems can achieve a higher education through the Muskie School. There's Young People's Caucus, where youth are in contact with decision makers and legislators to relate any type of issues that's going on in the community so they could advise on top of policy. And I'm also sitting on the board of the commission in Portland, the Race and Equity Committee, here right now. So,
do you feel as though meaningful change is underway?
I think that there's a calling right now, and anybody that's in the work is probably just getting kind of burnt out the same way I am. At the same time, very, very optimistic, very happy that a lot of the issues that we've been dealing with for most of our lives and for over generations that it's finally getting addressed in bigger platforms when it comes to policy, when it comes to school boards, when it comes to regular education, when it comes to anywhere and everywhere that's public, that the public needs and strives to go to. I think that it's you see it everywhere now. It's accepted to talk about it.
And Ali, I want to ask you, as we look back at the protests of last summer, what do you think their role was and how meaningful do you think they were in igniting the movement or not?
Well, there's three different types of activism. The first type of activism is protesting, campaigning, all of that. That's like the power of the people. That's really, you know, showing sign that a lot of people are amongst this type of movement. Then the second type of activism is advocacy, which is, you know, lawyers and advocates like I am that have a previous experience in different things that can advocate for other people that are harmed, that are being harmed by the system. And then the third one is direct service, which is like, you know, people that are doing, you know, theater to for like social change, people that are doing yoga, that are trying to help people that or assist anybody that's been through any type of trauma. So of the three, with regards to the protests, I think the protest did exactly what it needed to do, especially in all 50 states, all over the world. Everybody's doing this work. Even if you've seen yesterday's NFL Super Bowl, they even said that $250 million is going to systemic racism. So it's the platform is everywhere.
All right. Well, Ali, thanks so much for calling in. Abdul Ali, a leader in the anti-racism movement in Portland. Going to move along now to Representative Rachel Talbot Ross. Rachel Talbot Ross, thank you so much for calling in. I understand that you have stepped out of a committee meeting to call, so we'll try to be quick.
Oh, my goodness. No worries at all. Thank you, Jennifer, for having me.
And you are Assistant Majority Leader. You have introduced a bill, LD2, supported by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, that would incorporate racial justice impact statements in the legislative process. Tell me what that means. What will it mean as a bill goes through the legislature if this is passed?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. I will give the audience a little bit of framing first, and that is that LD1, which is a bill that was introduced by the Speaker and the Senate President, attempts to look at the COVID relief, the pandemic of that we're in now, the crisis of COVID. And LD2 is our racial impact statement that would be required in the legislative process. So the context is LD1 and LD2 absolutely represent the twin pandemics that we're experiencing now, with the COVID and addressing systemic racism. LD2 is a bill that would allow for this particular year in 2021 for the legislature to really take a look at the data that we currently have and adopting a methodology for analysis that would allow us to know the impact to our racial populations and tribal populations before a bill gets enacted. So much that we have in law right now, as people know, was written in race-neutral terms in hopes that it would address systemic and structural racism. However, it has not done so. So just because a law says it may do that, it has not done so. And we know that by looking at the historical racial disparities across all systems. So in 2021, if this bill passes, we will come up with a methodology for data analysis in order to be able to tell what that impact is if we should pass a law. In 2022, which is the second term of the 130th legislature, we're going to actually demonstrate that. We're going to say, okay, we came up with this methodology. Now let's apply it. Up to four different committees to see if the methodology works. 30 days after we adjourn in 2022, we will see what it looked like to enact this methodology. So going into the 131st legislature, which would be 2023, we would actually start requiring racial impact statements in the legislative process. The whole goal is to reduce those disparities and start to eliminate the structural systemic racism across all systems.
Representative Ross, you're also chair of the Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Maine Tribal Populations. What is the work of that commission right now? What's going on?
Sure. So a little bit of background. The Permanent Commission was created as an independent entity in the state. Mission is to advise all three branches of government, so the judicial, executive, and legislative branches, on issues around systemic racism through the lens of these disparities. Permanent Commission advises three branches of government. It also can submit its own legislation and it can raise its own money. The uniqueness of the Permanent Commission is that it includes all four tribal nations as opposed to one tribal representative. It's a 15-member commission. Again, its work is to advise all three branches of government using a racial equity and justice lens to eliminate disparities. Our current work is right now we're doing two things. We are writing a strategic work plan so that we can stay focused in moving that forward. At the same time, we're trying to be responsible for the moment. And we are looking at legislation that's going through with an eye towards being able to weigh in on legislation that will help meet those goals. So we're doing two things. We're working on a plan that will keep us focused, a multi-year plan that will keep us focused for years to come. And we're trying to figure out how to respond to the, I guess it's probably 1,800 bills that are going through the legislative process now so that our voice can be heard in that as those bills move forward.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Rachel Talbot Ross is the Assistant Majority Leader in the Maine House of Representatives. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners shut out the cold with air sealing, insulation, and window replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. We'll have the latest on the response to the fast-spreading COVID-19 variants here in the United States and how countries around the world are coping with the pandemic and handling vaccine distribution. Those stories and the latest news next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us. Here and Now upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Thank you for helping make our Pledge from Home Community Impact Drive a tremendous success. The drive officially ended on Friday evening, and we raised more than $303,000 and welcomed in 331 new members and counting. Your donation was not the only investment in the trusted news and information you rely on. You've also helped to fight food insecurity in Maine. Through a special partnership, your many calls of support resulted in our friends at Maine Community Foundation providing 75,000 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank. Thank you for doing your part to make the Community Impact Drive a success for public radio and for our community. You made a difference, and thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about the work being done in different areas of Maine to end systemic racism. My guest is Advocate for Racial Equity and Reconciliation, Dustin Ward. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go now to Ijoma Obi. Ijoma, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Tell us about your experience. You experienced racism as a student at Bangor High School and then called attention to it. Tell us your story.
So when it comes to Bangor High School, in my 4 years of being there, I did experience some insensitivities, along with incidents that made me feel like as if I didn't belong in the community. So me and a fellow advocate, Amara Efeji, we went out of our way to really bring these problems to light, because our main goal then and our main goal now is to really make sure that everyone, no matter what creed or race, is able to have a welcoming environment in Bangor schools. And really, I think it highlights a lot of the problems that we see across Maine, in the sense that, you know, this isn't just a thing that happens at Bangor High, but a lot of times there is an insensitivity in relation to a lot of other areas in Maine. So really advocating about that was taking a step forward this summer to really highlight where, you know, a lot of people are sort of, you know, missing the mark when it comes to racial equality, and ensuring that at the end of the day, we can make a welcoming environment while at the same time ensuring that students have a safe environment to learn in. So, yeah.
Ijoma, do you feel as though since you've started this work, there has been progress?
I definitely believe with the help of my cohorts that there's been progress through everything. Besides just the article in the BDN, you know, the school board really did pay attention to our needs and what we were advocating for. So at the very end of the day, I believe that helped out in terms of the community understanding a lot of the problems. And ultimately, a lot of changes have been made, especially when it comes to the school board and how to report incidents of racism and discrimination and overall race education. And I really believe that's one of the biggest steps that has happened since this has all taken place, is really just more race education so that people can understand these microaggressions, can understand, you know, the dialogue between all these problems that, you know, ultimately things can improve.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Ijoma Obi, who was a Bangor High School student and experienced racism. And now we're going to turn to Karen Sickerts, who is in the chair of the Bangor School Committee. Thanks for calling in, Karen. You heard what Ijoma just said. Tell us what's going on in Bangor and what the school committee has been doing.
So, yes, we... obviously, because of everything that Ijoma and her fellow students had brought out, we've been working really hard to address that, because there is no reason why anybody shouldn't feel safe in school and feel that it's a comfortable environment. And their reporting prompted an outside investigation that looked into incidences of peer-to-peer racial bias. Also some bias involving some teachers and administrators, and also, and more importantly, a deeper culture of sort of discriminatory and biased behavior. And I think that's one of the things that Emoji was speaking to. And one of our specific concerns was, you know, looking at some of those languages that are used outside of the classroom and some of the dress code standards. So part of Bangor's mission is to inspire excellence as learners and as people, and we can't do that unless students feel safe. So the school has really been working hard at all levels to address the issues that the girls brought forth that came out in the investigation, and to look at sort of the causes of bullying and exclusionary behavior, as well as creating a culture that's fostering innovation and creativity and diversity. So some of the real specific things, and some of them have already been brought out, is, you know, we've created a DEI committee, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, that really brings in students and teachers and administrators and community members in order to ensure that we have equity across the board to create that sense of belonging and, you know, fair and inclusive environment for all of our students and for all of the different social identities. We've also done a lot with faculty, staff, administrators receiving diversity and racial sensitivity training. We've worked really closely with the city on some of these areas. We've really, really updated and been looking at a lot of our policies, which we've been working to update. As you may know, we're in the process of hiring a new superintendent. And so the steps that we are taking on the diversity and equity, we've really been able to put forward and use those in our superintendent hiring. So they've had some really direct impacts that are going to affect our school and our students for years to come. We've hired personnel, affirmative action coordinator. We've hired a new school safety and communications director. We've been doing a real deep dive in curriculum reviews, as well as the professional developing. We've also been looking at our reporting process and adding discrimination tip line onto our Bangor School Department app. We've been doing training for all students, especially in the sort of 6th through 12th grade. We have added a civil rights team to the grades 6 through 8. And, you know, really looking at incorporating best practices to address diversity and discriminatory language in and outside of the classroom. We're formalizing Bangor school department clubs and organizations so that one group doesn't feel like they're being left out. And it's, I mean, the list just kind of goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I really appreciate you sharing some of those with us and helping us get our heads around some of the things that you're doing, and I'm sure others are as well. Karen Sickertz is the chair of the Bangor School Committee. And Dustin, I know that you work with other school departments. What do you think of the kind of activities that Karen was talking about?
Ooh, I love it. I love it. And here's what basically, you know, Karen's saying is, we will not leave any stone unturned, and when it comes to the issues that were brought by Ajomi, like that is a true overhaul of really making change. So I love that they're really hitting all the gamuts, and they're going directly to the students, you know, changing that culture of behavior, but also coming out and saying, how do we get the city in on it? How do we change our practices? So that is a great model for what I think other schools can and should do. And the key always is, are you having representatives at the table who have experienced this racism, who have gone through this? And that's what I encourage. If people don't have that voice, we hope to be that voice as well, to say, okay, because I'm from Presque Isle, I've experienced the same things that these young girls have felt. And to see a school respond that way is powerful. So I love it.
Great. We'll go to Ethan, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Sorry. I was waiting on hold and didn't realize. Let me start off with saying I've lived in those communities in Minneapolis, in the black community right on the edge, and I've seen what that's all like. But there is racial injustice, and that's great to talk about and all that. But a lot of people on the right, I'm hearing, are concerned with all the stuff that's going on with the schools, and it's almost like it's a little too much as far as telling people what to say, and political correctness is, you know, it's a little bit too much, I don't know, authoritarianism kind of thought and speech police type thing. But it's a great subject, and believe me, we need to include everybody. But, you know, when you start to tell people and force people what to say and all this stuff, I think it kind of starts to go maybe, I don't know, maybe a little bit too far. But anyway, that's
okay, Dustin,
point.
Thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So, no, I appreciate Ethan's comment. I think he's talking about something that is a real reality. But what I would say is that what you're using for terms, this isn't political. This is about the humanization of black and brown individuals. What we're asking for, what the black community wants, is to not have language that is dehumanizing. And I think we need to educate, you know, folks on the right, or even, you know, folks in all facets, that when you use this kind of language, or when you're saying some of the things that were brought up at Bangor, that is dehumanizing. You heard she did not feel belonged. She did not feel like she was part of. That is not language we as a country need to be using. So I think we need to be careful with the terms we throw around, right? Authoritarianism. And I've heard that this is a Marxist or socialist. Those are words that we need to understand what they actually mean. And what we're calling for is just to change rhetoric so that we are not dehumanizing our black brothers and sisters. So I would tell folks, you know, we're not trying to silence. We want to help educate so that we are using good language. We have a culture that is accepting and welcoming. And I think that's that first step that we got to get to.
All right. Thanks, Ethan, for your call. We'll go to Penobscot and Lawton. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is how do you teach white males about white privilege and how that affects people in their daily lives? I'm an old liberal, you know, semi-retired white guy, but for a lot of my conservative friends, if you bring that up, they get defensive. And I'm just wondering, I know Obama talked about a standard set of facts is so important in justice and racial justice. So that my question is, how do you teach that?
Thanks. And Lawton, it's a big and important question, and it's coming with not much time left. So Dustin, quickly, please.
Yeah, certainly. So first step is we all got to accept a little bit of humility in this area. I think, you know, your white male counterparts should first take that step of humility. But here's what I usually do. It starts with race. The building of what race is, 1775, was really a differentiation of individuals based on skin color and human brain. From there, when we take that race, that structure that was created of differentiation is what then allows for the white race, which is what was constructed. It was used as white markers, denigrated black individuals. And so in that structure, white individuals were the dominant force. And by that very standard, when your structure is built that way, everything in which you do in that structure, and that includes when we talk systemic racism, everything you do gives you an advantage, you know, whether you like it or not. Now, what I would tell your white male counterparts, just because you're born white, does not mean that, yes, you can't change that, that you can't change that you're white, but you can do something about the structure. And that's what we're talking about today. How do we mitigate and change the structure that was built to be a differentiation? So a lot more that can be said on that. And you know, a short amount of time, it's hard to do it all. But hopefully that gives you a little answer to that reality.
Lawton, I thank you so much for calling with that thoughtful question. We'll go to an email from Vanessa. I question the effectiveness of implicit bias classes. It's too academic. I think exposing the police force and the public to black films can go a long way. In Maine, there's little exposure. Few whites have black friends or colleagues, though this is changing. I recommend Blackish. Comedy is a powerful tool for self-reflection. I recommend Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. So, Dustin, what do you think of this thought of Vanessa's that we're getting sometimes too academic and we just kind of need to get real about some of this?
To some extent, I would agree. I think depending on how you teach implicit bias, but I think that teaching does need to be balanced. You do have to explain why is it our human nature creates this sort of fear of the other. And I think that needs to be explained. But I give credit to that email is that I wouldn't so much expose our police force, but what things like Blackish and Uncomfortable Questions do is they bring real language to the conversation. So instead of us overthinking it, we're saying, how does this make me feel? And it goes back to the previous question about our conversations about the dehumanizing nature of language. And so what shows like Blackish do, yeah, they take some of the stereotypes that we've been experiencing and brings a little levity to them, which can be good. But Uncomfortable Questions is great because it's just using raw, true language to explain what we're feeling on a regular basis. So I would agree with part of her email, and absolutely, that can be a way forward.
Well, Dustin, I thank you so much for being on the program today. Dustin Ward, an advocate for racial equity and reconciliation, his organization, It Is Time. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, how the Biden administration may confront pressing national and international issues. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.